250's trembling headlight. At dinner, Lyle and Burnell and Bill sat together in the big loud room with more than 60 bikers eating and drinking and whooping it up, and Bill swore he'd never get on a motorcycle again. But then he said, "Well, we don't like to make decisions at night in our family." As he ate, Lyle kept leaning over to put his hand on his father's shoulder and saying softly, "You all right, Daddy?" Bill would nod and say yes, yes, he was fine. And he ate a big dinner of beans, tortillas, salsa, and chicken. Then he and Burnell got up from the table to turn in early. When he said goodnight to his son, Bill leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. Lyle and I stayed a little longer at the table, Lyle eating hot tortillas rolled up with sugar, which he poured out in a white cascade from the glass sugar shaker. In the morning, Bill was ready to go again. He and I rode together, vying for last place, through the next 2 days of goat track and sandwash. Lyle went fast, and we went slow, and although Bill and I got lost one more time in a tomato farm on the Pacific sand during a windstorm, we managed to find our way out again. And while a lot of the riders fell, neither Lyle nor Bill nor I did. David Booley tore the front fork off his 650 to avoid killing a rider who had tried to swim with more chain than he could carry and fell in David's path. At midday, we entered a vast dry lake bed as hard and flat as poured concrete and dusted with alkali powder as fine and white as confectioner's sugar. It was a chance for everyone to go as fast as they pleased, and we all took off in a towering cloud of dust that rose and moved across the land. I was the slowest one, as even Bill left me behind, and I quickly lost sight of them. But as I gained more confidence and speed, I decided to catch up. I nudged the speedometer above 100, then 110, then gradually began to see their dust cloud again and turned toward it. It was impossible to see tracks on the lake bed, so I had only a general idea of which direction to go. When the cloud of dust grew, so did my confidence, and I cranked the throttle all the way open and decided it would be best not to look at the speedometer again, which might scare me. Now the cloud was getting huge, and I could picture myself pulling up behind a group of green motorcycles at any moment, maybe even passing Bill. Then suddenly, out of the cloud, there appeared a battered red Volkswagen bus full of Mexicans. And at the last second, before the impact, I swerved off to one side, lost control of the bike, and skidded around until I became mired in a dry, sandy wash. The bus went roaring away, dragging its skirts of dust. The whole thing had been an illusion, and I'd barely avoided a bad accident because of it. The third day, we were flying up a dry silt road that gradually ascended the hills above that same dry lake bed. A dirty wind was blowing dust all over the valley, obscuring the mountains and making the lake bed impassable. I was going about as fast as I dared, feeling my bike's rear end skip and skid out from under me as I powered through, when the landscape, the jagged rocks and the alkali lake in the windstorm, and the high blue of the sky overhead all at once came together into a coherent picture. I became one with the terrain and the motion. I saw the fine fabric that the wind had woven out of sand and rock, and I understood the transformation that was taking place through this, the simplest of all machines, the wheel. The essence was this. When it was still, that wheel was merely a contraption of spokes and nuts, of rim and rubber, cobbled together by human hands, improbable as a saxophone. But by spinning, it became a singular jewel, a unity of glittering perfection, fashioned out of higher laws, transformed by wind just as the saxophone is when it is played. So with the land we covered. Now as we accelerated above it, touching it but lightly, it was soft as angora. But if my motion was disturbed, then this delicious frothy blanket would erupt into a thousand shards of rock and scalding sand, and all would resolve at once into the harsh reality of this lifeless lake. That's what falling was all about. Riding was transcendental. It was rolling the karmic wheel in order to ascend with angels out of the temporal hell of the flesh. falling was to re-enter the world as it was, the low world. Falling, we are all fallen angels. Hence, the treachery of our expedition was in essence the same as Satan's. Early bikers understood this concept and had named themselves accordingly. 6. The Sandpile Effect. At about 9:10 on Thursday morning, May 30, 2002, Bill Ward sat at the top of Hogsback Ridge on a natural shelf just below the summit of Mount Hood in Oregon. His team of four climbers had begun its descent. Chris Kern was a 40-year-old investigator from the New York Appellate Court. Harry Slutter was his old friend from Long Island. Slutter had met Ward, an experienced climber, through his job with a large commercial nursery that had offices in New York and Oregon. Ward, in turn, had brought along his friend, Richard "Rick" Reed, a local Oregonian who'd never climbed a mountain before. Reed, who would be dead within the hour, had been led to believe that Mount Hood was a beginner's mountain, suitable for his first climb. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a beginner's mountain. It's a concept that doesn't work, like beginner sex. One difficulty is that the standard route up and down Mount Hood is not technical. It's more of a hike on a steep snowfield. On a good day, you can walk it without crampons, snap some pictures on the summit, and be back at the Timberline Lodge ski resort for New Zealand fire-broiled, spicy lamb loin chops. It's a dangerous illusion because success depends on doing everything perfectly. Any fall is apt to be a very long one into inhospitable terrain. Mount Hood is an active volcano with glaciers, ice fields, sudden 140-mile-an-hour winds, and rime ice. The fumarole, a volcanic vent, sucks in those who fall and suffocates them with hydrogen sulfide gas. People slip and accelerate across the ice, slam into the steel wall, and die on the rocks. Sudden whiteout blizzards leave people wandering for days in the zigzag wilderness area or the crevasse field on the Elliott Glacier. Mount Hood claims at least one life each year. Some years, as in 2002, it claims a lot more. Starting at about 8:30 in the morning, Bill Ward and his crew had descended from the summit and gathered on the shelf above the steep Hogsback Ridge, a graceful catenary arc of ice that descends 1,000 feet from the summit. Kern put his axe into the snow as an anchor and belayed Slutter. He made sure that there was no slack as he fed the rope out to Slutter for his descent. If Slutter fell, the taut rope would stop him before he got going too fast. Recent rains, freezing at night, partly thawing by day, had turned the snow into a mixture of hard ice and soft slush, making it easy to fall, but difficult to stop. They had practiced self-arrest techniques in the days leading up to the climb. Everyone, including Rick Reed, the novice, had been able to stop. When one person on a team falls, he's supposed to shout, "Falling," and all the others are supposed to throw themselves down and bury their ice axes into the snow. The rope tying them together should arrest the fall. With experience and practice, it becomes second nature, a secondary emotion, such as remarks soldiers had developed in response to the whistling of high-explosive shells. But although it had worked in practice, belaying from a fixed anchor is more reliable. Once Slutter had descended 35 feet, Ward put his ice axe in, wrapped the rope around it, and belayed Kern. Kern pulled his ice axe out of the snow and started down. As he moved, so did Slutter, in order to keep the rope taut. The plan, the idea, was that everyone would move down on belay one at a time until there was no slack in the rope. Anyone who fell would fall only a few inches. Then, lined up like beads on a string on the 1,000-foot ridge, they'd pull the last ice axe and walk carefully down the mountain. Ward and Reed watched from the ledge until the rope was taut. Then Ward belayed Reed, who descended his 35 feet, taking up the slack between himself and Ward. Slutter and Kern moved, too, to keep the rope taut. When they played out all their rope, Slutter was 105 feet below the shelf. Kern was 70 feet down, and Reed was 35 feet below Ward, who still sat on the shelf with his ice axe in, protecting the team. Now Ward stood and pulled his ice axe from the snow, and the only thing holding them to the mountain were the crampon points. The system was free to behave as it might. It was a simple theory, and from my interviews of the survivors, it was clear that they'd given it a lot of thought. The difficulty with the theory was that the top man, Ward, must not fall. The order from top to bottom was Ward, Reed, Kern, and Slutter. If you drop a brick 6 inches, you can probably catch it safely. If you drop a brick out a third-story window, it could hurt somebody. There were 35 feet of rope between Ward and the second man, Reed. If Ward fell, he'd have to go 70 feet before the slack was gone. Think about catching someone who's fallen from a 7-story building. It's all about energy levels, and while they didn't put it this way, the climbers were attempting to manage the vast amounts of energy they had put into a system of rope and weights. Only at an instinctive level did they understand that it was critical to keep that energy from escaping all at once. Ward, being the most experienced, was at the top. Surely he wasn't going to be the one to fall. Everyone was worried about Reed. The word experienced often refers to someone who's gotten away with doing the wrong thing more frequently than you have. By roping themselves together, they had created a deceptive system. A rope is simple, yet capable of surprisingly complex behavior. It can transmit all the force imparted to it from an infinite number of points along its length. It can double and double again. It can transmit force along its length and deliver it somewhere else. It can stretch, shrink, vibrate, and break. It is such an elegant equation. But powered by the infinite resource of gravity and coupled to 4 bodies, it turns out to have a staggeringly complex array of outcomes. Slutter, the lowest man on the rope, was looking down at some other climbers. The 2 nearest ones had celebrated with him and his team just 30 minutes earlier, snapping photos, laughing, sharing water and candy bars on the summit. Slutter could see them now, John Biggs and Tom Hillman, both from California. Hillman was a Methodist pastor. Biggs was his parishioner. "I was making a mental note at the time of where Hillman and Biggs were," Slutter told me a few days later. "They were off to one side, so he assumed that they were not in his fall line." It was one of the many illusions of Mount Hood. Slutter turned to look over his right shoulder at Kern, 35 feet above him. "I had a better view of where the spine of the hog's back went." So he called up to Kern, "Back up a little and get yourself over the spine more." Then, out of the corner of his eye, Slutter saw a blur and felt the tremendous surge of norepinephrine. He believed that whoever was falling could not be from his group, because the blur was going to one side of him and not straight down toward the Timberline Lodge. 2 days after the accident, I made the same mistake of perception myself. I was climbing the mountain with Steve Cruz, the mountain manager for the ski resort. He asked me which way was down, and I pointed at the lodge. But a ball rolled from the top does not go to the lodge. It goes east into the Zigzag Wilderness, or west into the Elliott Glacier. Nevertheless, appreciating the precariousness of his position, Slutter reacted instinctively. "There was no hesitation," he said. He threw himself down and dug in with his ice axe. Moments before, another group of 4 climbers had appeared above Ward from the summit just in time to see what happened. The criminologist for Clackamas County, Tim Bailey, investigated the accident. In his report, he said that the entire fall took only 3 to 5 seconds, covering hundreds of feet on the way to a crevasse that cuts the Hog's Back Ridge about halfway down. A teenager named Luke Pennington was in the group of 4 that had appeared above the victims just as Ward pulled his protection. He saw Ward facing east, trying to turn and plant his left boot while descending. Then the one thing that must not happen did happen. The top man fell. "At that point, he slipped and fell," Bailey said. "When he slipped and fell, he landed on his back with his head facing down the mountain, and he started sliding downhill. Before his rope went taut against Reed's harness, Ward was going as much as 30 miles an hour, the equivalent of the speed you'd attain by jumping from an 8-story building. Once he took Reed, then Kern, then Slutter, the acceleration continued unabated. They had taken to the boundaries of their world for adventure, and as James Gleick writes in Chaos, strange things happened near the boundaries. With all that energy balanced on ice on a crampon point, it took only a slight tug, the pinprick that popped the balloon. "It played out in slow motion," Slutter said. "The speeding up of reflexes, the fast processing mode into which the brain and body go in an emergency, makes the world seem to run in slow motion. I know that Chris went into the arrest position, but I don't remember seeing him move. It's amazing because I didn't hear a word. Perhaps it was a result of perceptual narrowing. Perhaps no one said anything. I saw nothing else. I was facing up the hill. I remember looking at my axe dug in and my chest was on top of it. My head was cocked and my hand was over it." Slutter focused on the one thing that seemed most important, his anchor point. "Then I remember watching it ripping through the ice. I'm thinking, we're going pretty fast here. I was ripped from the mountain." Kern was ripped from the mountain, too, and remembers flying through the air. He couldn't tell how far, but it seemed like a very long way. When he hit the snow again, it was a stunning blow that broke his pelvis. Then, as the ropes began playing out and going taut, he was snapped free again, flung into the air, and sent rocketing down the mountain. Perhaps only a second had passed, perhaps two. All four were now in chaotic motion, accelerating toward Biggs and Hillman, who were carefully descending. They were less than 100 feet below. They had no chance. Bailey reported, "Mr. Pennington said when they reached the next group, they clotheslined Mr. Biggs. The four falling were falling in such a manner that the taut rope was stretched out and it hit Mr. Biggs. It actually knocked Mr. Biggs into the air." "I heard someone shout, 'falling,'" Hillman recounted. "They hit Biggs like a billiard ball. He was airborne for 3 or 4 feet and was knocked upside down. I saw the one Oregon guy hook his red rope on our blue rope as he passed. I knew that I would have to arrest 5 people, and I stopped watching and got down. I prayed because I knew that I would have 50 feet until they reached me," which was the length of rope between him and Biggs, "and then 50 feet more until I was engaged. I was ready." But with 100 feet of slack, at least a couple of the 5 bodies, maybe more, would fall 10 stories before they pulled Hillman's rope taut. By that time, the force was so great, thousands of pounds, that it ripped his shoulder from its socket. Still he held on. "I remember the axe ripping the ice all the way down until the crevasse." But it wasn't over yet. Just above the crevasse, perhaps 400 feet below, 2 teams of climbers were heading up the mountain. They were led by Jeff Pierce, a paramedic with the Fire and Rescue Department in nearby Tualatin Valley. He'd brought 4 other paramedics up for their first mountain climb. In addition, the department's physical fitness trainer, Chad Hashberger, and Cole Joyner, the 14-year-old son of one of the paramedics, had come along. After their 3 a.m. snowcat ride to the top of Palmer, the highest ski lift, Pierce had divided them into 2 groups. He led Cole Joyner and Jeremiah Moffitt, a paramedic, on the lead rope. The other 4 formed the 2nd team, led by Dennis Butler, also a paramedic, and the only other experienced climber among them. His team of 4 was still below the crevasse when the accident happened. Pierce had already led Joyner and Moffitt around the left side of the crevasse as they ascended. "I was coming around the crevasse," he remembered, "looking up at some other climbers high on the route above and planning my moves." Pierce wanted to stay out of the way in case someone fell, but because of a seemingly insignificant decision he'd made earlier to go to the left instead of the right, his team first had to cross beneath the higher climbers. He and Joyner then started moving to their right, but Moffitt was still in the fall line. Pierce looked up and saw the teams falling. He'd seen people fall before. "Therefore," as he told me, "I expected them to drop, self-arrest, and start descending again. But as the first rough images began to resolve in his brain, a tremendous jolt of chemicals flooded his system and set him in motion. I dropped and buried my ice axe. I really dug in, and everyone else did too. 6 human projectiles, tangled in a mess of ropes and bristling with the points of crampons and ice axes, were plummeting toward him. Bailey reported, "Now we have 6 climbers coming down." The other witnesses said by this time they were all bouncing off each other. They were spinning around in circles. Moffitt was hit so hard he was knocked unconscious. His rope jerked Pierce and Joyner into the crevasse where all 9 climbers hit the lower wall and settled into heaps of bodies. Biggs was already dead. Ward was buried head down in the snow, suffocating under a pile of bodies. Reed, on his first and last climb, was alive, conscious, and dying. At that moment, the manager, Steve Cruz, was opening the mountain for the day's skiing. He was at the top of the Palmer chairlift talking to a ski patroller when the boy in the lift house said there was a call for him. Cruz heard a sheriff sergeant tell him there'd been a 911 call reporting a climbing accident 2,000 feet above him at the Bergschrund, which is what the locals call the crevasse. It was a little garbled, a little wild, but it sounded as if a bunch of climbers had gone into the Schrund. Cruz's head snapped around. Far above, he could see the crevasse with a few small figures around it. He felt his heart tick into a canter. He knew this was going to be a big one. He grabbed his radio, called down to Jeff Fudo Flood, my ace cat driver, and told him to get up to the top of Palmer as fast as he could. He could see the yellow snow cat snort black diesel smoke as it began churning uphill from the Timberline Lodge. Above him, deep in the crevasse, Bill Ward, buried in the snow, had already suffocated. Chris Kern was folded in half, jammed beneath a rock with a broken pelvis. He was screaming in agony. Harry Slutter, who'd been leading the highest team down, had been knocked unconscious when he hit the crevasse wall. He awoke, jammed upside down, his ice axe still in his hand. The scene, lit by ice-blue sunlight, was surreal. Debris and snow were still pouring in from above. "I felt like I was drowning, breathing in all that fine snow," Slutter remembered. He righted himself and took stock of his injuries. He was almost certain that he'd broken both his jaw and an ankle, but he was more concerned about Biggs. "I think my body was on his or his on mine. There was no separation," Slutter said. He rolled over and checked. Biggs wasn't breathing. Slutter began trying to resuscitate him. Then Pierce, leader of the Tualatin group, came over and he confirmed what I suspected, Slutter said. John was dead. Kern was still screaming. Slutter shouted at him, "Put away the pain and hold on." He and Kern ran races together, and that's what they told each other when the going got tough. Kern quieted down and tried telling Rick Reed the same thing. Reed was talking as he died. Moffitt was moaning, babbling incoherently. Tom Hillman, the Methodist pastor, had been knocked unconscious, but his camelback water bag had burst against the wall, absorbing some of the impact. Despite that, he'd cracked a thoracic vertebra. Hillman, who was trained as an EMT, began assessing himself as soon as he awoke. "I went back to my EMT training, and before I moved, I did a mental evaluation. I thought at least I would have a tib-fib fracture, an ankle, or a femur. I was mentally ready. But when I woke up, I was amazed that I had not broken anything. I had torn muscle and ligaments in my arms, shoulders, and back from holding on to the ice axe in a rest. I wanted to be able to respond and go into rescue mode. But with my concussion, I was like molasses." It is typical of the best survivors that, despite his injuries, Hillman was surrounded, as the Tao Te Ching puts it, with a bulwark of compassion. His thoughts were not for himself, but for others. It is not insignificant that he had chosen to devote his life to the ministry. "The hardest moment," Hillman said, "was not being able to respond with the equipment and training I had." Every time Hillman moved, he brushed ice onto Kern, who would cry out in pain. Hillman crawled out of the way and lay down. Only Jeff Pierce and the 14-year-old Cole Joyner were nearly uninjured. They immediately set about helping the others. Dennis Butler, leader of the other team, which was still outside below the crevasse, began setting up a rope system to haul out the dead and injured. The type of accident that happened on Mount Hood on May 30, 2002, was going to happen, as it always does, to someone somewhere. All the available theory tells us that it is an inevitable part of the larger system that puts climbers on steep, snowy slopes in large numbers. Climbers travel in roped teams without fixed protection all the time. They get away with it, too. They use ice axes like walking canes on descent. All the elements of the system in the Mount Hood accident were normal and can be explained by normal accident theory. It was Charles Perrow who coined the term system accidents in the 1980s, and it's a fascinating, if academic, exercise to see how his work and both chaos theory and the theory of self-organized criticality dovetail. The Mount Hood accident involved two broad categories of effects: the mechanical system that the climbers were using and the psychology and physiology that contributed to the accident. In recent years, those who study accidents in outdoor recreation have begun to recognize that all accidents are alike in fundamental ways. If you find yourself in enough trouble to be staring death in the face, you've gotten there by a well-worn path. Your first reaction might be, "How could this have happened? What rotten luck?" But if you are alive afterward and bother to examine what happened, it will all seem as orderly as the Cajun two-step. What we call accidents do not just happen. There is not some vector of pain that causes them. People have to assemble the systems that make them happen. Even then, nothing may happen for a long time. That is how mountains such as Hood, McKinley, Long's Peak, and others get a reputation as milk runs. Many of the people who get into the worst trouble on such non-technical peaks are those who have climbed more difficult mountains elsewhere. Often they have climbed in the Himalaya or South America and come to Denali or Hood with an attitude that they're slumming. Perhaps they're doing a favor for a friend who wants to have the experience. Perhaps they're trying to climb the highest peak in every state. They are hijacked by their own experience, combined with ignorance of the true nature of what they're attempting to do. Perrow's Normal Accidents, first published in 1984, is a work of seminal importance because of its unusual thesis: that in certain kinds of systems, large accidents, though rare, are both inevitable and normal. The accidents are a characteristic of the system itself, he says. His book was even more controversial because he found that efforts to make those systems safer, especially by technological means, made the systems more complex and therefore more prone to accidents. In system accidents, unexpected interactions of forces and components arise naturally out of the complexity of the system. Such accidents are made up of conditions, judgments, and acts or events that would be inconsequential by themselves. Unless they are coupled in just the right way and with just the right timing, they pass unnoticed. Bill Ward had slipped and caught himself before, or was in a position where slipping didn't matter. He'd pulled his protection, too, but not just before a serious fall. Perrow's point is that most of the time, nothing serious happens, which makes it more difficult for the operators of the system, climbers in this case. They begin to believe that the orderly behavior they see is the only possible state of the system. Then, at the critical boundaries in time and space, the components and forces interact in unexpected ways with catastrophic results. The space shuttle had flown many times without incident. It had gone up on cold Florida mornings, and nothing bad had happened. The people responsible for it began to regard this outcome as the only possible behavior of the system. Then, one morning, the cold caused a rubber seal to crack. The engineers who understood the system better than those in charge had warned about the possibility. Under the pressure of schedule and politics, Challenger was launched anyway, and those in charge, along with the entire world, saw a graphic demonstration of another possible, if rare, behavior of the system known as the space shuttle. Perrow used technical terms to describe those systems. He called them tightly coupled, He said that they must be capable of producing unintended complex interactions among components and forces. In his view, unless the system is both tightly coupled and able to produce such interactions, no system accident can happen, though other failures happen all the time. The parts and forces and their potential interactions might be hidden and are difficult to imagine beforehand. The climbers could not see all the energy they had stored. Because they had watched self-arrest techniques work before, they couldn't imagine them not working again. The coffee maker or the toilet on an airliner is not supposed to be able to destroy the plane, but both have done so. An airliner is a perfect example of a complex, tightly coupled system. A large mass containing explosive fuel, flying at high speeds, and operating along a fine boundary between stability and instability. Small forces can upset it, causing the destructive release of the large amount of energy stored in the system. In that way, it is like the system set up by the climbers. The energy in their system had come from their own muscles, electrochemical energy produced as they climbed. As they moved up, they stored more and more as potential energy in the system, which was tightly coupled because of the rope. It was like blowing up a balloon. The tiniest pinprick, an almost imperceptible force, can release the air all at once. The climbers would have been better off if they had tried to descend the slope with no safety system at all. When a system is tightly coupled, the effects spread. In a loosely coupled system, effects do not spread to other parts of the system. Falling dominoes are a familiar illustration of how tight coupling works. Move the dominoes farther apart and knock one over, only one will fall. If the climbers had not been roped together, Ward wouldn't have taken everyone else with him. For that matter, if they had not misperceived which way was down, they might not have positioned themselves over Hillman and Biggs. But the accident was still no one's fault. There is no cause for such system accidents in the traditional sense. No blame, as the I Ching says. The cause is in the nature of the system. It's self-organizing. When Normal Accidents was published, neither chaos theory nor the theory of self-organizing systems was widely known or accepted. But it is possible to see hints of both in Perrow's work. Chaos theory arose out of a huge vacuum in the physical sciences, disorder. We see it everywhere we look, from the functioning of a living organism to the behavior of flowing water, turbulence, erratic behavior, non-periodic natural cycles from weather to animal populations. Classical physics ignored all that and used idealized systems to explain the world. But that left most of the real world unexplained. The errors in Newton's calculations of planetary motion were ignored until Einstein came along to explain them. Traditional economics assumed perfectly rational agents. So does traditional survival training. Neither assumption reflects the messy, real world. The idea of chaos theory is that what appears to be a very complex, turbulent system, the weather, for example, can begin with simple components, water, air, earth, operating under a few simple rules, heat and gravity. One of the characteristics of such a system is that a small change in the initial conditions, often too small to measure, can lead to radically different behavior. Run the equations 2, 4, 8 times, and they may seem to be giving similar results. But the harder you drive the system, the more iterations result, and the more unpredictable it becomes. Edward Lorenz, a meteorologist at MIT, was modeling weather systems on a computer in the early 1960s when he accidentally discovered that a tiny change in the initial state, one part in 1,000, was enough to produce totally different weather patterns. That became known as the butterfly effect, the notion that a butterfly stirring the air today in Peking can transform storm systems next month in New York, as Gleick wrote in Chaos. Classical science aimed at predicting an outcome, then conducting an experiment to confirm it. But natural systems don't behave so neatly. The specific details can be described, yet no one can predict the outcome. You can describe how the weather works with high school math and physics, but you can't tell very far in advance when or even if it will rain. You can predict that lightning will strike under certain conditions, but you can't predict when or where. When I was a teenager, I teased my father by saying that from living with scientists all my life, I had observed that they knew so much that they often seemed to know nothing at all. Classical science can't predict the behavior of a cloud, which is nothing but a bunch of water droplets moved around in the air by heat and gravity. Training and safety systems are also a form of prediction, since they aim to control the future. Chaos theory views such systems, which seem chaotic, as actually arising out of a simple, orderly set of mathematical functions. They may also produce effects that are the same at all scales. A cloud looks the same whether viewed up close or far away. So does a coastline. And much of what we call art appeals to the senses because of its so-called fractal nature. Notre Dame Cathedral is beautiful at any scale. From far away, you can see the buttresses and the pleasing shape. The closer you get, the more interesting detail you see, until at last you are looking at the tiniest of figures sculpted on its surface. Matter itself appears to be like that. Just when you think you found the smallest piece, you find another, even smaller one. The theory of self-organized criticality, sometimes called complexity theory, was developed hard on the heels of chaos theory by some of the same people. It asked and suggested answers to questions as fundamental as, where does order come from? How do you reconcile it with the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything is heading toward more disorder? In a sense, complexity was an extension of the thinking that gave rise to chaos theory. Indeed, it was often referred to as existing at the edge of chaos. There has also been strong objection to linking complexity and chaos and to using the term complexity. Like chaos theory, complexity theory postulated upheaval and change and enormous consequences flowing from trivial-seeming events, and yet with a deep law hidden beneath. Complexity theory is a bold attempt to explain everything all at once, and so far it's done a better job in some ways than either Einstein's relativity theory or Niels Bohr's quantum mechanics did. The climbers on Mount Hood discovered the enormous consequences of the trivial-seeming event of pulling their protection. Such upheavals are part of nature's mysterious tendency to create self-organizing systems at critical boundaries. The climbers did not recognize that they were part of a system that had reached that critical state where it would probably remain most of the time and where a seemingly insignificant force could set it going at any time. Per Bach, a Danish physicist, set up an experiment in the 1980s that graphically demonstrates how accidents happen in wilderness recreation, though this was not his intention. He was demonstrating how a self-organizing system works. He created a pile of sand, or a computer model of one, and let more sand dribble on it from above as if from an hourglass. As the pile grew, it reached a certain height and then began to collapse. The pile didn't get any shorter, but it didn't get any higher either. It simply continued in that steady state of continuous collapse. In his book Complexity, M. Mitchell Waldrop describes the resulting sand pile as self-organized in the sense that it reaches the steady state all by itself without anyone explicitly shaping it. No one had to design those collapses into the system. They were a characteristic of the simple system. It reached a state that some scientists call criticality, though again there is much argument about how to use this term, which has become jargon. In fact, Waldrop adds, the critical sand pile is very much like a critical mass of plutonium, in which the chain reaction is just barely on the verge of running away into a nuclear explosion, but doesn't. As more and more sand falls, there are many small slides. Now and then there is a great avalanche in which the mountain comes apart, but often nothing happens for a long time. There is nothing at all in the physics of silicon dioxide that could predict the behavior of the sand pile. You could use physics and chemistry to examine a grain of sand until your lights go out and never discover the sandpile effect. But the sandpile effect expresses a tremendous amount about the way all of nature works. And it explains as well why Perrault came to regard accidents as a normal characteristic of certain systems. The systems he called complex and tightly coupled are actually self-organizing systems. The accidents are the collapses, if you will, in big technological sandpiles, such as nuclear reactors and jet airliners. They all operate continuously in failure mode. Most failures, collapses, are small ones, such as a broken switch, a burned-out light, a busted rubber gasket, the glitches that we dismiss as normal. And they are normal. But, like the temblors in an earthquake zone, they are also harbingers of the larger collapses that must eventually happen. Small collapses are common on the sandpile. Large-scale ones are rare. But collapses of all sizes do happen with an inevitability that can be described mathematically as inversely proportional to some power of the size. With earthquakes, it's the 3-2 power, which curiously is the same power as the one used to determine the time that planets take to go around the sun, the square root of the cube of the size of the orbit. Similarly, fender benders are common, while 60-car fatal pileups are rare, but they both happen. Murder is common. 6-state murder sprees are rare. Mountaineering falls are common. 9 people falling into a crevasse with 3 fatalities is rare. That so-called power law is found extensively in nature. It's a more precise way of saying what Perrault was saying. Large accidents, while rare, are normal. Efforts to prevent them always fail. Both the sandpile effect and normal accident theory predict that space shuttle accidents in which the entire craft and crew are lost will happen, albeit with long intervals between them. The space shuttle Columbia disintegrated on approach to landing almost exactly 17 years after Challenger exploded. Such accidents are inherent characteristics of that system. NASA will investigate and explain all the details of how it happened, but knowing those details will not prevent the next accident. Indeed, the safety precautions they take may make it more likely. In connection with the Columbia accident, most engineers I spoke to speculated that the tiles on the underside of the craft, designed to absorb the heat of re-entry, probably caused the problem. Dan Kanin of Lockheed wrote in an email, "Every precaution and material science known to man has been applied to the problem of making the thermal protection system work. It's a known risk. The tiles are soft, and every astronaut knows that if the wrong ones are damaged, the shuttle burns up. But the odds against it are pretty good, especially when compared to the rewards of being an astronaut. So they're willing to take the chance. In fact, they fight for it, as would a lot of us. But getting the public to buy this is a lot tougher. Especially a public that expects every risk in their lives to be mitigatable to zero. It will be interesting to see if NASA tries to take on this challenge, explaining to the public that doing bold things isn't about engineering risk to zero. Shit happens, and if we just want to restrict ourselves to things where shit can't happen, we're not going to do anything very interesting." So, the accident on Mount Hood was predictable. But no one could know which climbers would fall, where or when, or with what injuries. As with the sandpile, the overall system involving gravity, mass, and simple materials obeys rules that can be known. Like the sandpile, the system the climbers used was poised at the edge of chaos, in a state of criticality. The small points of contact between each person and the mountain, crampons, the tip of an ice axe handle used as a cane, were like the interlocking grains of sand on the pile, set to release at the slightest touch. Every step was another chance for a slip, a collapse of any size. Most were small, 1 inch, 5 inches, and died out. At a less frequent rate, bigger slips occurred. Hillman saw Biggs fall that morning. He quickly arrested himself with his ice axe. There are 10,000 climbers on Mount Hood each year, and only one death on average. The power law applies. The bigger the accident, the less likely it is. I like Perot's description of such accidents because while he was talking about a nuclear power plant, he could just as easily have been talking about Mount Hood. Processes happen very fast and can't be turned off. Recovery from the initial disturbance is not possible. It will spread quickly and irretrievably for at least some time. What distinguishes these interactions is that they were not designed into the system by anybody. He's describing the self-organizing behavior seen everywhere in nature, which complexity theorists such as Stefan Wolfram believe probably gave rise to life and to us in the first place. The climbers were familiar with the system and had a good concept of how it behaved, but only with its more frequent, smaller collapses. Hillman's comment that he was ready to arrest 5 people falling 100 feet indicates how little he understood the amount of energy in the system. The large-scale collapse, when it came, did happen very fast and couldn't be turned off. It did spread quickly and irretrievably and allowed them no chance to recover. Less than 48 hours later, as Steve Cruz and I climbed up Mount Hood, we sat and rested on a rock between the lift and the crevasse. "This thing went critical faster than anything I've ever seen," he told me. Without realizing it, he was using the jargon used to describe self-organizing systems. 7. The rules of life. There are really 2 environments, 2 worlds on Mount Hood. One is tailored for the comfort and survival of people. The other is not. There are the ski lifts, the lodge, and the 5-star restaurant with its Pinot Noir and rosemary crostini. I'd seen it the night before at dinner. Timberline is a place where the chili is white and costs $6.75. The dessert is flourless, and the tea is tazo. With my silverware clinking softly, I could possess those millions of square miles of wilderness with an unwary indifference that no other animal would dare. The mountain was safely contained within mullioned window frames. At a nearby table, 2 scientists, one from Los Alamos, the other from Livermore, discussed the tax laws of their respective institutions while sipping an amusing little fumé blanc. And there were the happy children on their snowboards, riding the steel ski lifts which lay like the bars of a cage to contain the beast. But I can rule only my neat little model of that world. I saw how easy it was to cross that invisible dividing line between what has been adapted for us and what demands that we adapt to it. By the imperceptible increments of my footsteps, I changed the frame. The pretty lodge was reduced to a doll's house, while the wilderness, huge and voracious, exploded across my view. The rules changed, too. I understood then how Bill Ward, Rick Reed, and John Biggs, the 3 men who died, might have carried some of that attitude from the lodge to the mountain. Their success in life, their goals and plans and imagination, had brought them here. They'd made the money to do such things. They deserved the rewards that their mastery of life had brought them. Biggs was bent on climbing the highest peak in every state, so perhaps not even their combined experience could shake the view that Mount Hood was one more challenge to be met and managed. Mount Hood would not be managed. I'd seen John Biggs's brother in the parking lot the day after the accident, searching John's truck for the ignition key so that he might take a few personal effects home to the family. He'd just come from identifying John's body. John, who'd survived flying a fighter plane in Vietnam and a career as an airline pilot, only to be killed by a beginner's mountain. The people were part of the mechanical system, but they were also a system in themselves, and without knowing any scientific theory, there was less esoteric knowledge that might have helped them that day. All of the rescue professionals I spoke to at Mount Hood seemed to understand the fundamental mistake the climbers had made. Jim Tripp is head of the ski patrol for Mount Hood, and one day he invited me to his office to talk. I found it in the ski patrol room, an institutional-looking place with 6 bunks under orange, blue, yellow, and green bed covers. There were stuffed animals on a high shelf, and ski company stickers plastered all over the steel cabinets. on the toe of one set of skis, Danger airbag installed. There were dispensers of orthoglass synthetic splints, along with oxygen and IVs, cervical collars, and backboards. This place was all about pain. The only illumination in Tripp's cluttered office came from a single desk lamp. Tripp is tall and lanky, and in this place of perpetual snow, he wore blue jean shorts, sandals, and a gray sweatshirt, feet up on the metal desk, cocked back in his secretary's chair, hands folded behind his nearly bald head. He wore a big grin as I came in. He looked like an aging surfer, and knew as much about Mount Hood as anyone. When I asked him about self-arrest with an ice axe, he just laughed. "If there's only 10 feet of slack, it can pull you off," he said. "If you are a true master, then maybe, maybe you can self-arrest. The first rule is, the top man must not fall. He's going to go 100 feet before the rope is taut, and you are screwed. This mountain is just not taken seriously. Fat people go up there." Experience can help us or betray us. Bill Ward had had 3 to 5 years of climbing experience, and it led him to pull his protection, which led to his death. Peter M. Leshak is a wildland firefighter and a gifted writer. In Ghosts of the Fireground, he writes of waiting too long to get out of a fire that was overtaking him. "I'd perhaps been too well trained," he says. "I was a victim of a common fire service mindset. Can do. A crew is ever anxious for the action and the novelty. Our instructor had drummed a phrase into our heads. When in doubt, don't." He's talking about a theory called risk homeostasis. The theory says that people accept a given level of risk. While it's different for each person, you tend to keep the risk you're willing to take at about the same level. If you perceive conditions as less risky, you'll take more risk. If conditions seem more risky, you'll take less risk. The theory has been demonstrated again and again. When anti-lock brakes were introduced, authorities expected the accident rate to go down, but it went up. People perceived that driving was safer with anti-lock brakes, so they drove more aggressively. With the introduction of radar in commercial shipping, it was expected that ships would collide less frequently. The opposite proved to be true. Radar simply allowed the owners to require the captains to drive the ships harder. Technological advances intended to improve safety may have the opposite effect. Leshak said of his near-death experience, "We were normalizing risk. We'd been through a similar situation and had emerged just fine. If you tallied a lot of experience in dangerous, iffy environments without significant calamity, the mental path of least resistance is to assume it was your skill and savvy that told the tale." That same trap kills a lot of experienced climbers, skiers, hikers, boaters, cavers, and so on. Heraclitus said that every time you step into the river, it's a different river. Every time you walk on Mount Hood, it's a different mountain. To use the technical terms, it's a boundary condition, a phase transition zone. And because of that, even if you are intimately familiar with its subtleties of character, it can make a mockery of the most thoughtful plans. Experience is nothing more than the engine that drives adaptation. So it's always important to ask, adaptation to what? You need to know if your particular experience has produced the sort of adaptation that will contribute to survival in the particular environment you choose. And when the environment changes, you have to be aware that your own experience might be inappropriate. Climbers might read Accidents in North American Mountaineering, ANAM, an annual summary edited by Jed Williamson. In his analysis of an accident that was almost identical to the one on Mount Hood, Williamson wrote that the 3 common factors in most mountaineering accidents are 1, descending, 2, roped together, and 3, no fixed protection. A rope without fixed anchors invariably becomes the primary mechanism of multiple injuries during a fall. Headlines in the Oregonian, Portland's daily newspaper, would scream that it was just a freak accident. It was not. It's a very common one, repeated over and over on numerous mountains. The most experienced mountaineer on Hood put it this way: "A rope without fixed protection is a suicide pact." The person is always a part of the system. Charles Perrault calls them human-machine systems. In river running, you don't feel like being stationary. Once you're moving, it takes a lot of self-control to stop and scout or decide to portage, to disengage the human from the system when it may grow too chaotic. The same was true for the Canadian snowmobilers who were caught in an avalanche. Staying put was safe, but it didn't cut it emotionally. The same can be true of climbers descending. There are three main difficulties with descent: attitude, an emotion involving goal-seeking, and stress. In the first case, those climbers, like most, celebrated reaching the summit. "It was such a glorious morning," Slutter recalled. "We were enjoying the moment. We were joking around up there for half an hour." Laughter again. Humor. The de-escalating emotional response. The trap lay in the fact that they were only halfway to their real goal. They were celebrating when they had the worst part of the climb ahead of them. Climbers are the only sportsmen who do that. Moreover, it is part of the natural cycle of human emotion to let down your guard once you feel you've reached a goal. When they took the snowcat to the top of the Palmer ski lift, they were geared up for action, excited, and perhaps a bit anxious. The familiar adrenal response took shape to promote action. It powers the rising curve of energy until the goal is met, the hunt, the mating, the fight or flight. It was followed by a grueling climb of 5 hours. By the time they reached the summit, the chemicals of emotion had been metabolized, even as the body burned its reserves of glucose. They felt that the action was over. They didn't think it. They felt it. Laughter and celebration lowered their guard further. Energy took a downward curve toward rest and recuperation, just as it would following any other burst of activity. Their focus had been sharp in the goal-seeking phase. Now it grew blurry. Various stresses contribute to falls on descent. Most climbers reach the summit tired, dehydrated, hypoxic, hypoglycemic, and sometimes hypothermic. Any one of those factors would be enough to erode mental and physical abilities. Put together, they make you clumsy, inattentive, and accident-prone. They impair judgment. They could, for example, contribute to a decision to descend without fixed protection. Tired muscles are less precise in their movement, making a slip more likely. Stress can trump all the other effects. The correct term is actually strain, but stress, mistakenly used by Hans Selye, a Canadian researcher in the 1930s, has stuck as the accepted usage. The stresses involved in wilderness recreation activities are more than enough to set about organizing an accident. Last, there is the fact that descending is technically more difficult than ascending. During the climb up, your foot is planted before your body weight is shifted. The opposite is true on descent, and it's less stable. Descent, like the act of walking, is a controlled fall. Even with unimpaired thinking, there's no guarantee that things would have gone any better. People routinely fail to realize that an accident not happening is no guarantee that it won't happen. As Scott Sagan puts it in The Limits of Safety, things that have never happened before happen all the time. Unfortunately, as Perrault comments, it is normal for us to die, but we only do it once. Which is too bad, for it might be the ultimate learning experience. So the climbers faced downhill now, with the Timberline Lodge in view. Suddenly, the high of the summit celebration turned into the prospect of a long slog down to the lodge. The Pinot Noir, the Rosemary Crostini. Images of previous experiences blossomed across numerous brain areas. The climbers saw rest and safety close at hand. Just get down the spine to the lodge as quickly as possible. Belaying is tedious, time-consuming, tiring. They were already tired, had already consumed enough time. Spinning rapidly and unconsciously through the options, they hit those emotional bookmarks, and one of those bookmarks may have reminded the climbers that the act of placing one foot in front of the other would soon yield comfort, safety, relief. Another bookmark told them that belaying involved prolonged pain, thirst, hunger, and fatigue. The organism would not have been likely to vote for that. The climbers had no bookmark for falling down a 1,000-foot ridge, nor for the speed with which energy can build up in a rope system. Their successful self-arrest practice would